Welcome to the Anime Podcast, the only anarchist podcast in the UK that doesn't have someone from Oxbridge hosting it or involved. So today we're talking about the Red Brigade in Season 3, which is a season entirely about armed groups around the world, the good, the bad, and the ugly. This one is going to be a complicated one in terms of how do we feel about them as a group. There's some good things, there's some bad things. So we'll sort of dig into it and we'll see if we can come to a consensus by the end of it. I am James, your host, and I'm joined today by Alex, my co-host. How are you getting on today, Alex?
I'm doing okay. It was so hot I had to put my kilt on earlier. Nothing but my kilt. I probably should have just been naked. That would have been better. But it felt inappropriate as a kind of recovering Catholic.
So you went taps off, but with a kilt on.
Absolutely, in your honor, not that you knew until now.
But so what you're saying is you were wearing a kilt and thinking about me.
I was rubbing my nipples too, but I didn't want to bring that up.
Okay, good, right. And hopefully in a state of more dress, we're also joined by a very special guest, Grant of Real Politics Podcast, also Wario. Oh, I've forgotten his at already. What's your at again, Grant?
Wario Tifo,
that's it. Famous destroyer of melts on Twitter. How are you getting on?
All right, thanks for having me on. I can confirm I'm fully clothed. It's always a good way to start a podcast.
Are you rubbing your nipples though?
Not yet. I'm hoping that'll get in the mood for that maybe halfway through the recording.
You definitely will.
Yeah. Get that full-on gold dust move going.
That's an excellent 1996 reference. Well done.
There's nothing quite like the capture of Fiat Punto owners and bosses to really get the nipples hard, I feel, for the left. So yeah, let's get straight into it. So as I said, we're talking about the Red Brigade. Very complicated group. Are basically Marxist-Leninists in Italy throughout the 70s and 80s was when they mainly operated in. They were armed, they used a variety of terrorist tactics, we would say, to try and turn Italy into a communist country. They had the specific aim of separating Italy away from NATO. So does anyone want to go into a bit more detail about them?
I'm going to try and be brief, even for me, because there's just too much history here to go into. We did an episode last season about World War II, and we touched upon basically what happened post-war in places like France and Italy, and about how the CIA at the time, which was the OSS actually, basically spent a large amount of money on undermining the communists, who were at like 40% in the polls in Italy at the time, and were likely to win because they had been the partisan movement during World War II fighting against Mussolini. If you fast forward a bit, by the 48, 49, just after the election, a broad collaboration of secret services, neo-fascists, actual fascists, police is created called Operation Gladio, whose main job was to, in very unpleasant ways, undermine the left, which often came in the form of the communist parties, as a threat. Now, why I say that is, if you fast forward into 1968, where you have the big kind of street protests, they kind of in Paris, you have basically a second commune, major danger to the establishment. Out of this comes the Red Brigades in Italy, but also out of this comes a kind of a new kind of wave of support for the Italian Communist Party. Younger people seem to think, well, the Italians are, Italian Communist Party is trying too hard to get elected. And this is where there's a kind of a splintering. So at the same time in America, you have groups like the Weathermen who use pretty similar tactics to the Red Brigades. In Germany, you have the Red Army faction, otherwise known as the Baader-Meinhof group. If you've ever seen the movie, The Baader-Meinhof Complex, you'll know about them. And so basically it's the younger baby boomer radicals who feel that any type of parliamentary tactic is not acceptable, but at the same time, there's a broader kind of wave of the left on the rise. So this is kind of the background to the formation of the Red Brigades in Italy.
Have you got anything to add there, Grant?
Not really on the history stuff. You know, that's sort of where anybody came out of. I don't think I've really got much to add to that.
Yeah, I mean, it is kind of important to note the way that World War II did affect this group, and the way that Italy's politics was formatted from the end of World War II. And, you know, as we were saying in our podcast about the World War II, that we did focus quite a lot on the Italy front there, and the most expensive election up until recently of all time, I think, was in Italy, where on one hand you had the Soviets funding the communist parties, but you also had, you know, the UK and the US funding the democratic Christian parties to try and destabilize the region back into fascism, effectively, because unlike Germany, a lot of the fascists were welcomed back into Italy and didn't really face much consequences. So they were able to set up quite a lot of neo-fascist groups, and they also used deadly force. So it was sort of an imperative, I think, for communists to be armed and defend themselves, because it was, you know, a possibility that things were going to go sideways again.
Just very briefly, briefly this time, post-war groups like Operation Gladio, but in general, places like Germany, Italy, a lot of fascists were either rehabilitated, not prosecuted in state and government, or found their way through the police or the secret services to survive and stay in power. And that was one of the big things in Germany and Italy that that outraged young people at the time, was that these were the same people who had led the countries into disaster in World War II, and they were still there, and they were still fascists, and including in Germany. Like, it wasn't a secret. It was there at the time. So a lot of kind of the radicals, if you will, in Germany and other places, in France as well, but mostly in Germany and Italy, they very much felt that the entire state of Italy and the state of Germany had to be toppled because it was rotten to the core. So it's a very important kind of thing to understand as to why they felt it was okay to attack and kill judges, police officers, all these sorts of things. They felt the whole thing was corrupted by fascism.
So yeah, let's get into who exactly they were and what was their aims. So Grant, if you want to take us through a bit of that.
Yeah, so obviously they formed, I think, right at the start of the 70s and sort of built their peak maybe a few years after that. But they were very much, as you say, Marxist-Leninist. They were mainly, they'd sort of come out of the Italian communist youth, seen as the more extremist wing of that previously. And they were particularly clustered around Reggio Emilia in northern Italy. Initially, again, they became quite widespread afterwards. They were very much essentially that the, as well as targeting the right, that the sort of left establishment, if you like, was not radical enough, was not serious enough about this sort of thing. So they would essentially attack what they saw as conservatism in like sort of trade union movement, as well as like within, I guess, more electoral political channels. But from quite early in their existence, they were right from the start, I think they were quite controversial, like even within the Italian left. Many other groups, even far left groups, were sort of seeing them as quite extremist in their methods and their politics. But they were quite comfortable, again, from sort of 1972, 73 sort of period, with essentially using criminal activities to advance their goals, to fund themselves as well. And that is obviously something that's going to sort of come in with a fair few of the points we're going to discuss later on, I think.
It is kind of interesting to see how they developed as a group, because they did start off from like petty crimes, effectively just sabotaging machinery and factories, and, you know, helping strikes, but then, you know, the move on to actually capturing and kidnapping, you know, factory foremen or bosses, or and then they move up to governmental officials, usually to extort them. I did read that apparently they never tortured anyone. I'm not 100% sure if that's true, but that's what I read anyway. And it's not for this season that we're talking about, but I think if there was any group to start using those tactics in the West today, it would be considered fairly controversial, as it was then, but also fairly shocking. So what would be your response to that, Alex?
I think, certainly if they were if any leftist organization or group espousing left ideas were to start doing that, it would not be received well, and it would be very controversial, obviously. Yeah. The other thing I wanted to mention was that they, again, I don't know how much truth there is to this, because I'm basing this off a report in 1978 around the time of former President Morrow's kind of kidnapping, which we'll deal with in a bit. But so take it or leave it, whether it's true or not. But there was an Italian journalist who was kind of explaining the situation at the time, and she was of the opinion that the goal of the Red Brigade by then, in the late 70s, was to try and foment a fascist, or at least a right authoritarian dictatorship, so that they could kind of try and replicate the partisan conflict of World War II. Basically, by that point, the Red Brigades were of the belief that if simply just, you know, kidnapping and holding ransom certain individuals, or bank robberies, basically they weren't building up enough support. So, you know, this Italian journalist's view was the only hope they had by that point of actually being successful in kind of moving Italy towards kind of a communist country, or at least towards the Soviet bloc, was by fermenting this type of ideological war. At least, as we know, that it wasn't successful. So again, this is going to be one of those episodes where we look at a group that was really quite self-destructive, completely different to the last group we covered in the Zapatistas. They didn't seem to have a lot of common sense.
So right, you're saying they don't have a lot of common sense, but I think it's a very interesting tactic. It's definitely, if you say, like, look what would, you know, was happening in America at the time with their involvement in, say, you know, tacitly being involved with organized crime, and, you know, you're looking at the UK as, you know, the police are going around cracking heads as a way to defend yourself against, you know, effectively violent governments and violent capitalism. I'm not saying it's your go-to, but I'm interested in it as a way to defend your community. If, you know, someone's saying, like, oh, we're going to close down this factory, and there's many people are going to lose their jobs, et cetera, et cetera. Like, if you think that one of your foremen are going to be, you know, taken hostage, or that you're going to find, you know, that building gets burnt down, it makes you second guess it as an opportunity, rather than what would happen now. You would just go to the press, you know, if you're lucky, maybe the Canary or something like that would write a story on about it, no one will read it, and then nothing will happen.
But James, if that's what they were doing, I wouldn't have a problem with that, but that's not what they were doing. At least that wasn't what they were doing by the late 70s. They kind of pivoted away from merely kind of being representatives of the working class, or trying to kind of propagandize the working class in the factories in the north, which had engaged in rapid industrialization in the 60s, all of which you can read and watch about on some of the links in the footnotes of this episode. But, you know, by that point, they were, still relatively small in number, and, you know, were on the fringes, and they decided to... as they did in the early 80s, burn a lot of those bridges by murdering trade union representatives that they didn't agree with, or in general by, you know, we'll get into who exactly was responsible for the abduction and murder of Morrow. But that's, you know, if it was them, it was a very bad tactic to try and keep public support. So I would say if they were doing what you just described, I would agree, but I don't think they were doing that, at least not by the late 70s.
But you're getting ahead of yourself. We're still talking about, we try to do it in a chronological order, so we're talking about their early tactics.
Well, that's why I think they were successful, because those are good tactics.
Yeah. So, Grant, what do you think about these as tactics?
Yeah, I think, again, without wanting to preempt anything, where they maybe got a bit more deeper into things and compromised later on. But, you know, I think you can make the argument that it's quite sort of militant and direct tactics are justifiable, whereby the good outcomes you can potentially gain from them are proportionate to that. And I think when they're sort of taking mostly sort of involvement in strike action, obviously there's a lot of it around in Italy in the late 60s, early 70s in particular. It was a hotbed of class struggle. You can definitely make a case that, yeah, there's more ways to advance that than just sort of arguing to vote a certain way at the ballot box or saying it's all a waste of time. Again, so problems come in later on, but you know, whether this was the only way they could have gone, I don't know. But they clearly felt that the sort of electoral far left at the time wasn't sufficient, and that doesn't really leave them with many other options in the early 70s other than what they were doing, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, as they saw it, and I think most of us would broadly agree, they were saying that there was a government that was in place that was there to, like, keep elections rigged, and, you know, as most governments are, if not all of them completely, you know, to keep power away from the many and keep it, you know, for the few, and engaging in electoral politics or something like that was completely fruitless for them, because it was a rigged game, because, you know, the US would just funnel as much money into the parties that needed to win effectively. You have three sides happening in Italy at this time. You've basically got the far right, who are, you know, all fascist groups. There is, you know, loads of them also doing very similar tactics to the Red Brigade. You've got the New Order, the National Vanguard, people like that. They're bombing places. They're doing political assassinations, kidnaps, etc., etc. But they are, and we know now for sure, like, definitely funded by MI6 and the CIA and other groups. Now, how that money got to them, I'm not 100% sure. But, you know, get to them, it did. Basically, in the center, you have, and center with big quotation marks, you have basically a sort of Christian democracy that are looking to try and bring the church back in, because even though Mussolini wasn't a religious person per se, he was definitely someone that saw how the church could be utilized. So they definitely knew that they had a lot of bad blood with a lot of people, the way that they jumped into the bed with fascism. So they were trying to some extent, you know, bring themselves into the, you know, the center of Italian politics. And then on the left, you've got places like the Red Brigade, but you've also got, you know, the more Trotskyist Communist Party.
Just a kind of a small disagreement with what you said at the very beginning. You mentioned that there was kind of three different sides. I don't think there was. I think there was two. There's a documentary listeners will find in the footnotes by the BBC, believe it or not, in the early 90s, back when, bizarrely, even though the Tories were in power there, they seemed to have more of a backbone. And they did a whole three or four episodes on Operation Gladio. And they were pretty clear that from the get-go, the Italian establishment, backed up by the CIA and MI6 and other groups as well, used fascists as puppets. You know, they basically grabbed a couple of these anti-partisan fascists from the north, protected them, made sure they were never prosecuted for the thousands of people they'd killed. They used them in the 40s and 50s, and then fast forward to the 70s, and they literally just created these fascist groups out of almost thin air. There's an interview with a fascist who had avoided prosecution, and they were interviewing him in early 90s. And he said, yeah, most of the groups didn't really believe in anything. They were we were just puppets. We were being paid. We were mostly part of this kind of underground Operation Gladio group. And we were just kind of told, given our marching orders. So I think it was literally just this, the establishment and the kind of the shadow establishment, you know, the shadow secret service in form of Gladio and the Italian Secret Service that created the fascists to basically allow the state to hammer down on all groups, because remember, there's bombings and murders, by far more people die, in fact, by killed by fascists than are killed by the Red Brigades. Red Brigades, maybe 75 people are killed. About 400 people are killed by the fascist groups, including a bombing in 1980 in Bologna. They killed 88 people. There was a bombing in the early 70s by the fascists. They killed 17. By far, they kill more people. And that drives more power into the hands of the state. So I think it's actually more a battle between the state and what's seen as its potential threats in the Italian Communist Party and in the Red Brigades, really.
Yeah, and this time in Italian politics is called the Years of Lead, which sounds like a fucking great Sergio Leone film. But that gives you an idea of, you know, where the Red Brigade are. This is the world that they're living in. Now, they did, I would say, have a part to play in that world with their tactics, but it didn't come out of nothing. It didn't, you know, they didn't start the flame. You know, there was already this tinderbox waiting to go off, and they were, you know, instigators in, I guess, the left-wing violence, but they were by far, you know, not the only, you know, violent group around. And as the 70s progress, they start to become more bold in their tactics. So they move from, you know, just intimidating, you know, workers and bosses at plants and things like that, and actually start moving into bank robberies and drug trafficking, arms trafficking, and things like that. But you also start to see them, and this is where I'm going to get with the next question, is that as they saw it, you know, their members are being arrested and shot by security forces. And those that are being arrested, they are intimidating the judges, but they're also intimidating the jurors under the claim that they're saying, look, this system, the law that exists as it is engineered specifically against us. It's not a completely, you know, fair court. So it's within our right to intimidate the jurors to get our outcome, which is the correct one. So what do we think of that as a tactic for the left? Or, you know, is there good points to it? Is there bad points to it?
Yeah, I think even allowing for the differences of a time, I think probably intimidating jurors is one of the first things where you may be struggling to justify what they're doing. I'm wondering, sort of tying up a couple of things we've sort of discussed already. Italy, I think, more than a lot of similarly sized European countries, has quite radical variances in like regional politics. Like obviously in Britain, for example, you get cities with slightly different political characters. You know, Liverpool, you'd say, was slightly more left-wing than a lot of cities. I think Italy is quite dramatic with that, with some in some parts, there'll be parts far to the left or far to the right of the national sort of politics of the time. And I wonder if that's why the sort of focus on crimes to essentially raise funds, getting involved in things like the drug trade and that sort of thing, were to maybe help channel the support in places it would be harder to organically grow. But with the intimidating jurors, you know, you're essentially... It's a change, isn't it, whereby you're not taking action against political actors, be they politicians, be they trade unionists, be they bosses, be they factories, but to sort of, although it's the court process, although it's still part of like the hated state and so on, it is it's the public involvement in that they're targeting. It's almost, you know, sounds like a bit of a mild thing to say, but I wonder if it's good, if that sort of thing is going to do more harm than good, in the sense of it lets them be framed as just sort of a criminal enterprise that happen to use politics as their motivation.
Yeah, out of all the groups that we talk about in this season so far, where they tend to go wrong is, you know, sort of this point in their arc. I think if you're a left-wing revolutionary group that is armed, like, you basically have to play on nightmare mode, because you have to, one, be morally right all the time in your tactics, even though you know that the other side are going to play dirty as much as possible. But, you know, if you slip up in one little way, the entire media apparatus is going to come down on you and really paint, you know, everything you do as the act of terrorists or mafioso or something like that.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think it should be brought up, given our own political bent, that I think it was 1973 was one of the first fascist bombings. Certainly the one that killed up until the late 70s the most people. I think it was in, I can't remember where it was, but you'll find it in some of in the footnotes anyway. But 17 people were killed, and in the aftermath they blamed it on an anarchist. And the anarchist was brought in to, I think it was in Turin, and mysteriously threw himself off a balcony the next day and, as you might imagine, died. Now, it's always been denied that they killed him, but come on, they fucking threw him off a balcony. It was already by that point well known that the police would beat, sometimes to death, left radicals. And you have the police, we now know, being well aware that Operation Gladio, these type of secret groups were in existence, and that they were funding and channeling money to the fascists, who themselves were killing police too. Again, this is a very deep, dark, dirty war that exists. So if I'm a Red Brigader and I know this, why wouldn't I think, well, the only way to survive is to use the same type of tactics? And if that means kidnapping industrialists, murdering industrialists, if that means threatening jurors, because I believe the balance that, you know, you're not going to get a proper trial. If you're not going to get a fair trial because the evidence is made up. And again, there's a lot of evidence of that in the 70s and 80s, that the magistrates would just make shit up. The police would just concoct evidence. I mean, it's not surprising. None of us here would be particularly surprised if the police would get up to that now, let alone back then. So, you know, I can understand the reasoning. At the same time, I think you're right, though, James, that you have to be aware how this looks for propaganda purposes, you know, because in the end, most people weren't aware of any of these things at the time. And so even if you're a Red Brigader and you know it, you kind of have to understand where the public are, and try, as annoying as that might be, and try and play to that. So if targeting jurors may not be the best idea, given the circumstances.
Yeah, it's kind of, I think, you know, out of all the groups that we've talked about so far, obviously the one that they share the most similarities with is the Black Panthers. And I would say that the Red Brigade never really started as well, or had the same, you know, authenticity, I guess, is, you know, maybe the best way to put it, as the Black Panthers did. But they seem to fall down in the exact same way, where they just sort of move from the sort of Robin Hood scenario into becoming what they're painted as. And, you know, as we, you know, the last episode you're talking about the Zapatistas, that's just, they never fell for that. You know, they continue to just do their own thing. And I wonder if it's something to do specifically with maybe Marxist ideology that has a grain in it that means that you're going to go down this route, or it's just so easy to happen.
I think there's probably an element of that. There's also an element of they were not as rooted in their community. I mean, to what extent they lost their community, which was the industrial workplaces in Northern Italy, as they had to go out in the run and basically were no longer rooted in that, like the Zapatistas. And Zapatistas are still rooted in their communities and are responsive to them. Whereas I don't think many workers would have agreed with what they began to do in the mid to late 70s. And it should be said that, you know, they never really got a hand on the fact that the police and secret services had infiltrated them. This is how they get most of the original leadership get arrested in 74, because there was a double agent or whatever, an infiltrator. And then after that, a second generation of leaders take over. And there's a lot of belief amongst many people, it's never been proven, that Moretti, who was kind of the leader after the second generation in the late 70s, that he was actually in some fashion on the payroll of Operation Gladio or the Italian kind of secret service. That never was able to happen with the Zapatistas because it was a solid kind of movement, you know?
Yeah, that kind of takes us on nicely to what we're next talking about. And this is sort of what the Red Brigade are really famous for. And it's also, I would say, like the real turning point as them as a group is their kidnapping of the former president of Italy, Aldo Moro. So, Karan, do you want to take us through some of that briefly?
So, obviously, this was, it's no surprise really that this is what they've become sort of largely known for in the wider audience, because, you know, it really was high profile. This happened in 1978. They kidnapped Aldo Moro, who at the time was a sort of key negotiator aiming at shoring up like the government's position and their majority, but basically trying to get a compromise between the Italian Communist Party and more mainstream parties, although they were quite mainstream at the time. So they kidnapped him, but Aldo Moro was a twice former prime minister at that stage. He'd been prime minister from late 1963 to 1968, and then again for 18 months between 74 and 76. So it is, it's essentially the equivalent of someone, kidnapping Gordon Brown or John Major or something in terms of, like, this is obviously going to cut through to people who aren't paying attention, going about their lives in Italy and not paying attention to all the deep ideological warfare going on in the 70s. They took him captive. They actually killed five people in taking him captive. They killed his bodyguards, and they wanted the release of prisoners. That was their demands, essentially. They did not really get much cooperation whatsoever. No one was negotiating at all, and then they ended up holding him for quite a long time, for almost 2 months, before they realized that they not only were they not getting anywhere with the negotiations, the demands rather, they weren't going to get anywhere. So they killed him. They shot him 11 times, left him in the trunk of a car in a way that was obviously going to be found to make a statement. This and it immediately caused what essentially you describe as a massive clampdown on the Red Brigades, that it essentially allowed the state and the police to treat them as an open terrorist group, in a way that maybe wasn't quite as acknowledged before.
Yeah, what I didn't know until researching for this episode as well is there's actually lots and lots of conspiracy theories about this kidnapping as well, and how close the validity is, I'm not actually sure, but they say things along the lines of they used a different route every day to go to where they were going, and the bodyguards had locked their weapons away before they got into the car, etc., etc. Now, using these things, I don't think that really gives you much of an indication that it is a conspiracy theory, because security services are not always known for their great work, even if they are being paid quite well. And also, like, you're using the different routes things, like, everyone's fall of that. There's only so many routes. There's ways to plan for these things. But what I think Alex believes and has really been pushing from the beginning of the podcast is, by this point, the Red Brigade might not be all that they seem. So if you want to go into that, Alex.
It is so murky as to, you can't prove it. Moretti himself has never said that this happened, because I think he's maybe dead now, but when he was in jail, spoiler alert, many of them end up in prison. He never admitted it, but then again, it's not something you particularly would admit. And I don't think you need to be a genius to figure that out, that at the time, there's not a lot of advantage from the Red Brigade's perspective to doing to kidnapping him. There is actually quite a lot of benefit to for the establishment of Gladio and the kind of Italian Secret Service to actually get rid of him, because at the time he had secured a negotiated kind of government between the Christian Democrats and the Italian Communist Party, which had never happened before. It'd been, you know, 40 years of coalition governments in which the Italian communists were kept out, and now they were going to have a say in the power of the government in 1978. And it's very easy to imagine the same way that, you know, the Scottish Nationalists, which were a completely different thing, obviously, but remember in 2007, they got a bit of power, a minority government, and then 2011, they sweep in and with a majority. It was pretty easy for CIA, MI6 to say, well, look, one deal like this now will legitimize them. They'll be in government within 4 years, and then they're going to pull Italy out of NATO. So many of our nuclear weapons are kept in Italy. It's a great base for the Mediterranean, for the British and American fleets. You can absolutely see how people who we now know, like, again, for people listening, this isn't a conspiracy theory in the sense that we about Gladio. We know it existed. It's been 30 years now since that was revealed. It's been admitted that they engaged in murder of innocent civilians, probably hundreds of innocent civilians over the years. I mean, none of this is particularly surprising. And it wouldn't be particularly surprising if a piece of paper was found tomorrow, which we had a payment slip from, you know, the Italian Secret Service to Moretti. It's easy to imagine them saying, we've got you over a barrel, we're going to do this and this to you, or we can do this and this and to you if you don't kind of go ahead with this plan. And that's all it would really need to be. It's not to say that the people who actually carried out the ambush and the murder were representatives of any, you know, secret group. I think they were the Red Brigade. I just think that the motivation to go after him doesn't make any sense. And I know I said at the beginning that they lacked common sense, but this is more than lacking common sense. This is an insane thing to do at the time if you're in their position. And I think it's backed up by how the Italian government reacted. They didn't negotiate for the release of the fucking prime minister because he was going to be prime minister again. That's no way that doesn't happen. I mean, it's an insane thing. Like, of course they would have negotiated, but they didn't because they wanted him dead.
Yeah, and it should be stressed as well how much America was shitting its pants about this this proposed vote as well, where Henry Kissinger was effectively, you know, openly threatening Italy at the time as well, saying, like, you know, under no circumstances can communism come to power in Italy. And really, they were, you know, really trying to throw their weight around. And what also should be pointed out as well is the consequences of this kidnapping meant there was a general strike by communists to distance themselves from what was happening. So that really gives you an idea of, you know, like, it didn't seem like they were linked with communities anymore, or, you know, a wider left. It seemed like they were pretty much doing their own thing. And this was how they, at this point, operated. They were effectively a sort of more left-wing mafia. So after that, they're effectively, as Alex was saying, like, targeted to an extent that they were pretty much taken out. And they continue to exist to some extent up until the 2000s, where, you know, they fled to France and other places close to Italy. So what do we think, this all considered, what do we think that the Red Brigade's legacy is? So what, you know, what can the left learn from them? And often, you know, with these groups, it's what, you know, what to do, what not to do. So, Grant, what do you think the left can learn from the Red Brigade?
Well, I think one of the difficulties here is some of the changes that have happened in the world since the 70s. I think in particular, if someone was looking to, like, do something in Europe, anywhere in Europe, really, on the Red Brigade's model and, you know, change it here or there to fit their own ideological aims, you know, I'd imagine you'd have covered it on another episode at some point. But the fact, you know, with sort of enhanced forensic developments and like, much, much more in particular of, like, a surveillance society, it would be much harder to to do the sort of the criminal things that the Red Brigades did, to get away with them for long on any scale. But in terms of their legacy, I mean, I think really they've almost proven a bit self-defeating with the fact that they're the best known for a political murder and for some of their other things, intimidating jurors and things like that, their involvement in organised crime. They've almost become a sort of folk demon separate from what their actual ideological aims were, in that they can be the sort of truth that feeds the frequently deployed lie of the far left as terrorists and so on. You know, so they must have been connecting with people perhaps more than we've given people credit for, because when the Moreau assassination did eventually go down, they arrested something like 12,000 people. Now, I'm sure they were being quite liberal in how they were defining involvement, but you can't really imagine a sort of hard left sect certainly in the UK having that many active members. But yeah, again, it all comes down to some of the roads they chose to go down without really thinking of the consequences of it, I think, has meant that the bad sort of outweighs the good in terms of what people think of them now. You know, there've been some sort of, I think, people using the name in Italy since a bit more recently in the late 1990s, but almost would have been an anachronism then. Can't really see that model coming back in the near future anywhere, really.
Well, given the fact that their sister group in Germany is a fucking punchline, a very humorous punchline in the form of the Bader-Meinhof complex, but it's a good movie, but they're, Jesus Christ, they're so ridiculous in that. And in many ways, not too dissimilar to them or the Weathermen, who kind of the same. Now, here's a good example of how some of the tactics that were employed by the Red Brigades were also employed by the IRA. What's the difference? The IRA is rooted, or was rooted, in a community. And a lot of the things they did could be stupid or could, and were stupid, but they were able to survive by hiding within the community. They didn't have a community by the late 70s, if they ever had one. And certainly were not like the Zapatistas, who were, you know, always subservient. Their wishes were frequently, at least, subservient to the wishes of the majority of the native population in the Chiapas. So that didn't exist with them. The Marxist Lenin, I think, like, to be a sectarian for a second, the fact that there were Marxist Leninists and were trying to kind of move Italy towards the Soviet bloc, I mean, I think that's a huge problem that needs to be talked about. The left in general doesn't like to talk about the USSR or the legacy of that. You know, I think you'd be, you know, be silly not to bring up the fact that groups like the Bader-Meinhof and the Red Army factions, called the Red Brigades, they were getting funding in some fashion, though they've always denied it. I find it hard to believe they weren't getting their weapons, or, you know, they were certainly getting their training through the PLO, which was getting its money from the USSR. So again, I think that has to be brought up. That would, you know, being completely unrooted is a really bad idea. Ignoring government infiltration was a terrible idea. Ignoring your allies, even if you're not as extreme as you, and telling Communist Party doing very well, having a bit of common sense is a good idea too. But I mean, my main thing that I learned from this is that if this is what they were doing in the 70s, if this is what Gladio was doing, and this is how the left was responding, you have to imagine it's so much more complicated now and so much more effective. One of the things I wanted to bring up before we finish the episode was, do you guys, and I think James was hinting at it earlier, do you see any type of comparison to how Corbyn was torpedoed? No, I don't mean it in terms of like the MI5 killing people or bombing people and like that. But I mean the tactics used against Corbyn. Do you see any type of comparisons in terms of how a left group can be just so easily whittled down, not only because of its own internal contradictions and problems, but by these kind of large state apparatus. You know, I think it's hard to look at Corbyn or, you know, a lot of left, you know, a lot of left wing groups over the last 20 years and not see that we've not learned the lesson of taking the enemy seriously with, you know, and how well organized and how dangerous they are.
I mean, I don't think Corbyn really works as a good comparison, because I think what we've been finding out as the years have gone by is that they didn't take a lot of things very seriously. You know, Corbyn, McDonald was saying a couple of weeks ago that, you know, someone was saying, oh, well, what was your plan to deal with MI5 when you got into number 10? And he was saying, well, we didn't have one. And I think that just shows you, like, in some ways, like, the Corbyn campaign was actually fundamentally unserious. If that's their, if that's what they're, you know, they're not even planning for that with the full knowledge of, you know, like, I'm pretty sure that McDonald and Corbyn would remember, you know, life with Harold Wilson. And so they're also joined to a party that was, in, like, by the time that, you know, Corbyn came to power, was completely and utterly designed from the ground up to stop something like Corbyn happening, and he got through basically by mistake. So I don't think it really works, because it's, you know, it was like a small speck in a bigger party that was, it was kind of destined to fail, because, you know, he didn't take the steps that were necessarily to bring the party into line. Where I think if there was to be a left-wing party to some extent, I know, you know, obviously we don't really agree in that party politics is the way to go, but if there was something that was, you know, had grown to the point where they did decide to start standing candidates, they would full know and understand which way they were going to be attacked in the media, and you can plan for that, and you get ready for it, and you work your way through it. You know, I would say like Sinn Féin is a good example of that. They know exactly where their attack line is going to be, and it doesn't really work because they refuse to be baited into the situations that you know, the Irish Times tried to bait them into. So, you know, I'm not saying that Sinn Féin are perfect, as, you know, as we say in the podcast all the time, but when it comes to their media game, they're a lot more savvy than Corbyn was.
What does Grant think about that? Because obviously he actually lives in the UK. I mean, obviously it's not a direct comparison, but what do you think about the fact that the left, at least those who were supportive of Corbyn, haven't learned at the very least a lesson that there's this very large and insidious force out there, MI5, and to ignore it is just insane, or to not take that into account, much like the Red Brigades didn't take into account.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're looking at several decades of the sort of political centre, if you like, quite aggressively framing any sort of questions like you're asking now as conspiracy, you know, as baseless conspiracy. Despite the fact that there's actually loads of evidence out there. Someone mentioned Harold Wilson, you know, his second government was hugely impeded by the security services. I think we've kind of touched on it with the Corbyn project, in that they weren't expecting to have a left-wing leader of the Labour Party in 2015. I think people like Corbyn and McDonnell, who've been active on the Labour left, running these contests so that they can just keep the fire burning and keep things active when there might be a chance to get a left-wing Labour leader 10, 25, 40 years down the line. And they were caught on the hop enough by Corbyn actually being miles ahead in the polls in 2015, within that contest, that they didn't have a strategy or anything like that. But I think a lot of their compromises are almost driven in sort of trying to appear to be reasonable and trying to appear to have reaching for a wider appeal. But it's a funny one, because I'm sure they could tell in pretty greater detail than we could all the things wrong with the British press and the problems with it. But they seem to have that sort of naivety that they could just sort of maneuver their way around it without going in two-footed on it.
Do you think that the left, I mean, one last question, because I know that it's getting long, mm-hmm. But do you think the left and the Red Brigades are an example of this, are perhaps misinformed as in some fashion, or too naive. I think you used the word naive, someone did. Is the left, like the thing they always say about Lenin and Marxist-Leninists, is that they're hard-nosed and they're a bit more quote-unquote realistic about human nature, in quotation marks. Do you think the left needs to be more, well, I'll use the word cynical, because it's not cynical, it's realistic, but do you think the left is falling down a rabbit hole of thinking, well, my comrades are lovely and, you know, I don't need to take precautions, I don't need to have a game set, you know, a kind of mind on, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that there's an element of that, certainly with like internal organizing within various groups and communities. You need to be able to do the necessary, even if the easier option is to sit around and have a debate about it and explain why left-wing views are better than your centrist views and so on. Like, in practice, you're up against quite often quite cynical actors who have got a lot more experience in winning these little internal battles and sort of framing their ideas to the public as well than we have. And I think the left could often do with being a bit blunter and a bit more focused on winning the internal battles rather than winning the internal arguments. It's a difficult one because, again, you know, prior to 2015 and the recent Corbyn one, there's just so little actual working examples to go off and learn from in recent British history. You know, I do think there's a lot of genuine cases with Corbynism of people genuinely going to it quite wide-eyed and being like, "Well, we can talk the bastards round," and learning in real time that you can't. Got to make sure that doesn't happen next time if there is a next time.
Yeah, I mean, when we came up with the idea for this season, you know, just doing it all about armed revolutionaries, to big and small, and, you know, some of the groups that we were looking at, we don't really agree with in lots of ways, mm-hmm. but, you know, they've had some sort of success. I kind of, just because it was just a topic that I was interested in, I thought it would be a good season arc, but what I'm starting to realize is it's useful for is, you know, it's discussing tactics that maybe worked in the 70s and, you know, or the 40s or something like that, and looking at them now and I'm like, well, what's good about them and what can you change about them to make them work now? So, you know, like with the the Black Panthers, obviously the schools, you know, feeding the school children thing, right? That's great PR. You get your message out there. You actually do something like that's brilliant. But they also did the things like, you know, they stood and they, you know, watched the police with guns. You know, that was their early tactic. Now, I'm not saying, look, go out there with an M15 and stand around watching the police. But, you know, what if there was a left organization that had GoPros, you know, attached to their chest, and their only job was to not get involved with police action or interfere with it, but it was just there as a group to record what the police were doing when they were making arrests. You know, I'm not saying it is a goer as a tactic. It's just, you know, it's a tactic to put out there to have a discussion about. And what we need to do as the left is actually just start having these conversations, start thinking about these things, start looking at what worked and what didn't work in the past. Because at the moment, we're not doing anything and we're getting our arses handed to us time and time and over again. And, you know, like, not every group is going to give you a good framework to work from, but what did the Red Brigade do that worked? And what did it, you know, not work? And, you know, in the early days, like, intimidating, you know, bosses is an interesting idea to go down, because, you know, in Dublin recently, Debenhams closed down, and the you know, there's been an ongoing strike where, you know, the police have been you know, pushing through scabs to take the stuff out and things like that, and, you know, there's no redress, there's absolutely no way through the media or through the court system to make those workers get what they need. So you need to start looking at other ways other than, you know, just standing around out in the cold. So Alex, we'll make this your final note there.
Yeah, just to kind of piggyback on what you just said, one of the things we didn't mention was that in the early 70s, they kidnapped an employer who had fired 600 employees, and they basically held him until he agreed to give them their jobs back, and he did. So therefore, there's a good example of it working.
Yeah, and legally, we must point out, we're not telling you to capture your boss, but it might not be a terrible idea in the future. So yeah, we're going to leave it there. So thanks for joining us for another episode of Anime. You can follow Garant at Wario Tifo, and he's also... are you a co-host now?
I've been a co-host on Real Politics for about 3 years, ages now.
So 3 years? Okay.
Near enough. It's about 2.5, 3 years.
Importantly, you joined after the Daily Mail headlines.
Yeah, that was quite smart. Although the Daily Mail have gone after my Twitter account in the past as well.
But for separate reasons.
For very separate reasons, yeah. I got a Matt Chorley byline on that one, in fact.
Cool. So that'll do us for today. And our next episode is going to be about the PKK with Shun and Koss. So enjoy yourself, folks, and have a great week.
Shout out to Andrew Neil and his flopping, failing GB News.